stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
A top U.S. diplomat makes an unannounced visit to the Middle East, and Israel continues searching for three missing teenagers. I'm Marty Johnson reporting from Washington. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry has made a previously unannounced visit to Egypt for talks with President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi. Kerry arrived in Cairo today for the highest level meeting with the new Egyptian leader since the country's presidential election. He first met with his counterpart, Foreign Minister Sameh Shoukry.
Obviously, this is a critical moment of transition in Egypt with enormous challenges. The United States is very interested in working closely with President al-Sisi and his cabinet and Egypt in order to help make this transition as rapidly and smoothly as possible.
The U.S. has expressed concern about a crackdown on dissent since Mr. Sisi took power as the country's military chief last July, ousting the Muslim Brotherhood. The crackdown has left hundreds of people dead and thousands others imprisoned since the military took power from Brotherhood leader Mohamed Morsi. Sunni insurgents led by the Islamic State of Iraq in the Levant, or ISIL, have seized two more towns in Iraq's western Anbar province. Security officials say the insurgents, a group that splintered off from al-Qaeda, are now in control of Rutba and Anna. Meanwhile, Secretary of State Kerry begins his diplomatic mission in Egypt, but is centering it on consulting partners about Iraq. Kerry stopped first in Egypt, then goes on to Jordan later today, then heads to Brussels for the NATO foreign ministers meeting and on to Paris for meetings with regional partners and Gulf allies. Israeli officials say an explosion destroyed a vehicle in the Israeli-occupied Golan Heights, killing a 15-year-old boy who was at work with his father. Security officials say it appears the vehicle was either the target of a roadside bomb or an artillery shell or mortar fired from Syria. Authorities say if the attack did come from Syria, it would be the first time gunfire from the Syrian conflict has killed an Israeli. Ahead of this morning's cabinet meeting in Jerusalem, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said Israel has conclusive evidence that Hamas is behind the kidnappings of three Israeli teens, and they are sharing that evidence privately with several other countries before making it public. Israeli troops shot and killed two Palestinians in the West Bank today in separate incidents related to that search. One Palestinian man was killed in the Nablus area. The second died in Ramallah, the Palestinians' administrative capital of the West Bank. Russian President Vladimir Putin says Moscow will support Ukraine President Petro Poroshenko's call for peace talks over eastern Ukraine, but so far the fighting continues. Mr. Putin said a political compromise should be reached that ensures the rights of Russian-speaking people living in eastern Ukraine. Mr. Poroshenko said he would negotiate with separatists who are not implicated in the murder and torture in eastern Ukraine. French President Francois Hollande and German Chancellor Angela Merkel are calling on all sides to end the fighting. Pakistan says more than 300,000 people, including women and children, have left its North Waziristan border district where an army counterterrorism offensive is underway. But a senior minister rejects UN reports that thousands of Pakistanis have fled into Afghanistan seeking safety. Ayaz Gul reports from Islamabad.
The fighting has caused a flood of people to flee Waziristan. Federal Minister Abdul Qadir Baloch is supervising relief operations for the internally displaced people. However, Baloch says few families have shown up at the relief centers.
They don't like to stay in the camps. They prefer to go back, to go to different areas, to their relations, and to take houses on rent, live elsewhere instead of living in the camps.
The minister says families are being provided with food, drinks and cash to meet their urgent needs. He tells VOA that the number of refugees is swelling by the day and is expected to go well beyond 400,000. Ayaz Gul for VOA News, Islamabad.
Hundreds of Afghan demonstrators have flooded the streets of Kabul in protest of alleged fraud in the country's recent presidential runoff election. Protests yesterday disrupted traffic on the main road to the airport, but the gathering was mostly peaceful. Riot police prevented protesters from entering the airport and stood watch in case of any violent outbursts. Former Foreign Minister Abdullah Abdul has accused the electoral officials of trying to rig the runoff in favor of his opponent Ashraf Ghani Ahmadzi. And in World Cup action Saturday, Argentina won over Iran 1-0. Germany and Ghana 2-2 was a draw. Nigeria wins 1-0 over Bosnia-Herzegovina. I'm Marty Johnson reporting from Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. I'm Douglas Mpuga.
And I'm Odette Fraser. Thanks for joining us. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry makes unannounced visit to Egypt for talks with President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi.
To take thee, Gertrude Hendrina Maseko, to be my lawfully wedded wife, and your Lord shall separate us by death.
Malawi's new president, Peter Mutharika, marries his longtime girlfriend.
And no, FIFA is trying to do with LOC and with the Brazilian authorities, security authorities, in order to improve the standards and improve that this will not happen again.
And authorities in Brazil beef up security around stadiums. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry has made a previously unannounced visit to Egypt for talks with President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi. Kerry arrived Sunday in Cairo for the highest level meeting with the new Egyptian leader since the country's presidential election. Kerry first held talks with Foreign Minister Shammeh Shoukry. Kerry said the U.S. is very interested in working closely with the new government in order to make the transition as smooth as possible. The United States has expressed concern about a strong crackdown on dissent since Mr. Sisi took power as the country's military chief last July, ousting the Muslim Brotherhood. The crackdown has left hundreds of people dead and thousands of others have been imprisoned since the military took power from Brotherhood leader Mohamed Morsi. The government has since outlawed the Muslim Brotherhood and sentenced hundreds of its members and other protesters to death in trials that lasted only a few hours.
Armed men in Nigeria have attacked a village in the country's northeast, torching houses and killing several people. Saturday's attack in Koonginim village took place about 9 kilometers from the town of Chibok, where Boko Haram militants kidnapped more than 270 schoolgirls in April. Nearly 60 of the girls escaped soon after the Boko Haram raid, but Nigerian officials say 219 remain unaccounted for. The Chibok kidnapping and other attacks in the area have underscored Nigeria's inability to stamp out the militant group, which aims to carve out a radical Islamist state in the mostly Muslim north.
And now on to Malawi, where the country's new president, Peter Mutharika, has married his longtime girlfriend, former Member of Parliament Gertrude Maseko. Mr. Mutharika lost his first wife 30 years ago, while Maseko and her first husband divorced 10 years ago. For VOA, Lameka Masina has this report from Blantyre.
Malawians braved cold weather on Saturday to gather outside the small church in Blantyre, where the wedding ceremony took place. Clad in a grey suit, the 74-year-old president was the first to take the marriage vow.
As Peter Mutharika, to take thee, Gertrude Hendrina Maseko, to be my lawfully wedded wife, and your Lord shall separate us by death.
After Maseko recited her vow, an officiating clergyman, the Reverend Rabson Chikwezule, made the declaration.
I, the Synod Moderate of Blanda Synod, therefore, pronounce them to be husband and wife in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. What God has joined together, man must not separate.
The relationship between President Mutharika and Maseko dates back to 2009. He had been serving as education minister in the former Democratic Progressive Party administration, headed by his older brother, the late President Bingwa Mutharika. During this time, Maseko, now 54 years old, was a DPP member of parliament, a position she lost during the general elections held in May. Mr. Mutharika has long been accused of being gay despite fathering three children with his first wife. The accusation reached the boiling point in the run-up to last month's election. After Saturday's ceremony, Mr. Mutharika said the wedding had cleared up the mysteries. He was speaking to an estimated 6,000 villagers and dignitaries who attended a reception at his home village in the southern district of Cholo. Many people in Malawi have held the wedding, saying this would help to smooth the new president's social and political life. The outgoing European Union ambassador to Malawi, Alexander Baum, congratulated Mr. Mutharika on getting married. Baum spoke during his farewell party in the capital, Lilongwe.
I see that His Excellency President Peter Mutharika has accepted that behind every successful man, there must be a woman.
Chairperson for the committee that organized the president's wedding, Vice President Saulos Chilima, said the ceremony cost about $95,000 paid for by the well-wishers. Lamek Masina for VOA News in Blanta.
Members of the Mana River Union met in Conakry, Guinea on Friday to discuss the Ebola virus outbreak in the region. Sierra Leone's chief medical officer, Dr. Brian Makagbo, attended the meeting and noted that the group has agreed to certain strategies in an attempt to contain the spread of the virus. I spoke with Dr. Brian Makagbo on the line from Freetown, and he confirmed that there are now 147 confirmed cases of infections, with 34 confirmed deaths in Sierra Leone.
What came out very clearly was that all the issues are the same, more specifically the issue of denial, detachment, and cultural practices. What we have agreed was that all our messages need to be harmonized, and at the same time, we need to do a concerted effort in tracing the contacts of those who are infected. At the same time, we should have a common strategy to fight the Ebola virus.
You talked about a common strategy to fight the virus. What's the common strategy that you guys are going to use?
What we are going to use, one is for us to have what we call the interpersonal communication among community members, and at the same time to ensure that wherever there is a case of Ebola, we need to report to the next country for them to be able to look out for those who may have come into contact with that individual. And also, we need to standardize our diagnostic tools so that whatever we say here is positive, we reflect also the same test that will be done in Guinea and Liberia.
Now, why do you think the infection rate has been so widespread and seems rather difficult to contain in the region?
Most of the issues remain the same issue of denial. Even when we started this case of Ebola, when it was identified on the 24th of May in Sierra Leone, a lot of community members did not believe that it was Ebola. That is why you are seeing this increase in number of persons infected with the virus.
As at today, how many people have been infected so far?
As at today in Sierra Leone, we have 147 confirmed cases. We have 34 confirmed deaths. But there are probable deaths that may have occurred at the community level, which we did not confirm as having Ebola. They may have come into contact with persons having Ebola, but the confirmed cases that we have for death is 34 in Sierra Leone. The confirmed cases in the region as a whole, according to the latest report that we have, is now more than 400 in the region.
Sierra Leone's chief medical officer, Dr. Brima Kagbo. I reached him by phone in Freetown, Sierra Leone.
Back in Nigeria, the ruling party toppled the main opposition candidate in a state governorship vote this weekend, officials said, giving President Goodluck Jonathan a boost ahead of national polls next year. Ayodele Fayose of the People's Democratic Party's PDP took almost 60% of the vote in southwestern Ekiti State, and sitting the opposition incumbent, Kayode Fayemi, the Electoral Commission announced on Sunday. Governors are among the most powerful figures in Africa's largest economy and oil producer. Some control budgets bigger than those of many African countries and play a significant role in selecting presidential candidates. The victory of Ekiti, where organizers said voting was fair and peaceful, was a rare piece of good news for a ruling party that is likely to see its sternest test yet in the 2015 national election. Jonathan has been beleaguered by defections of senior figures and criticism for his government's failure to quell Islamic group Boko Haram.
Politicians worldwide often vilify their opponents, and those in Nigeria are no different. As the 2015 elections approach, Nigeria's two main political parties are blaming each other for the violent Boko Haram insurgency in the north. As Heather Murdoch reports for VOA from Abuja, analysts say neither party is wholly to blame, but individual politicians from both parties could partially be funding the group.
In the past 5 years, Boko Haram militants have killed thousands of people, and as next year's elections draw near, the insurgency appears to be growing. More than 2,000 people have been killed this year alone in attacks on markets, military bases, bus stations, and even football viewing centers. In April, the Islamist radical group kidnapped more than 200 schoolgirls. At his home in the Niger Delta, Avi Joseph, a local leader within the ruling People's Democratic Party, or PDP, says the opposition funds the violence, trying to make the country ungovernable.
Where problems of kidnapping, Boko Haram, all that are coming, is a style of trying to destabilize the ruling party and its an opposition.
He says Boko Haram's increasing strength is evidence that wealthy politicians must be supporting the group. The opposition he speaks of is the All Progressive Congress, or APC, a mega party formed last year when several opposition parties merged. Analysts say if the party can stand behind a single candidate next year, it could prove to be a formidable opponent to the PDP, which has governed Nigeria since 1999. Christian Ononjacha is the assistant secretary of the APC in Delta State. He blames the ruling party for failing to stop the insurgency.
What they are now trying to do is to throw the blame on us that we are involved. But we are not involved. We are not in charge of the federal security apparatus. They are in charge.
He says the ruling party is wasting time pointing fingers when it should be fighting the insurgency. He concedes that individual politicians may be involved, but he thinks they are from the ruling party.
Our members are clean. They are people that we know can salvage this nation from the quagmire that it is currently.
But some analysts say that on this issue, both parties are correct and both are wrong. Jan St-Pierre, the CEO of Berlin-based security consulting firm Mosicon, says Nigerian politicians often hire thugs to intimidate their opposition.
Both sides use them depending on how greedy or ambitious the local politician was. They would sometimes use more of their services, sometimes less, but both sides, all parties were.
St-Pierre says the politicians may not be interested in Boko Haram's goals, but in northeastern Nigeria, the Boko Haram members happen to be the guys with the guns. The group is believed to be controlling villages along the Chad and Cameroon borders, he says. And in those areas, even conducting an election will require support from Boko Haram.
They intimidate, they terrorize, and when possible, they actually provide goods and services, which gives them the legitimacy that the sometimes, despite all everything that they're doing, that the government doesn't seem to have.
Boko Haram's name means Western education is sinful, and the group has threatened President Goodluck Jonathan by name. However, St-Pierre says while Boko Haram may be partially supported by a corrupt political system, the insurgents probably do not care who wins. Heather Murdoch for VOA News, Abuja.
In a country where only 15% of voices on the radio belong to women, one Ugandan radio station aims to make them feel they have a place in the media landscape. Mama FM is the first woman-run radio station in Africa, and as Hilary Hula reports for VOA from Kampala, its goal is to combat stereotypes and make sure women's voices are finally heard.
Grace Mazirwe, a university student in Kampala, knows she wants to work as a radio technician. But she says it's a challenging field, and at Ugandan radio stations, it can be especially challenging for women.
You know, sometimes ladies are not, who are engineers, they are not respected so much when they go out. Maybe they try to say they don't know. Maybe they are slow at learning.
That's why she chose to intern at a community radio station called Mama FM.
These people, they are really treating me well. They keep encouraging me. They are like, yeah, you can do it. You are a lady, but still you can do it.
Launched 13 years ago by the Uganda Media Women's Association, Mama FM is Africa's first radio station run entirely by women. Director Margaret Santamu says that in an industry dominated by men, it has an important role to play.
The goal of the station is to have a woman expressing herself without fear or favor, to bring more women voices in the airwaves, because we know that most of the mainstream media kind of marginalize women's voices and issues.
In a country where literacy rates are low, most people get their news from the radio. But according to Mama FM statistics, only 15% of the voices heard on Ugandan radio belong to women. Not only do men tend to be the ones speaking in the Ugandan media, says Santamu, they're nearly always the ones making editorial decisions. She adds that this affects the way women are portrayed.
Their pictures get in the newspapers maybe because they have stabbed a man, maybe they have been sexually violated, maybe they are fighting, and maybe sometimes you get women who are dressed skimpily, and that's when they appear in the media.
A radio station run entirely by women, Santamu says, projects a more realistic image of women's lives. But it also challenges the idea that women need to be managed by men.
This station was actually started to provide a platform for women to prove themselves that, yeah, we are here, we can handle, and we are in charge. When it comes to positions here, all big positions are managed by women.
Mama FM's coverage focuses on the problems and experiences of ordinary women. They broadcast a two-hour show on domestic violence, for example. And when they do cover breaking news, the focus is on how it affects women. This, says Santamu, is what sets their coverage apart.
I would say that we cover almost the same topics, but it is the angle that matters. Here it is women's angle. We know that men make news, but we make sure that women also comment on what men have said.
But it isn't only women who listen to Mama FM. A survey in 2007 found that nearly 4 million men and women across the country were tuning in. The youth are listening as well, says Santamu. And as more and more interns like Mazirwe are trained and move into the mainstream media, she adds, Uganda is starting to accept that women also have a right to be heard. Hilary Hewler for VOA News, Kampala. Put your flags up
in the sky. Hi, this is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports. Visit voafootball.com for live updates on the World Cup in Brazil. The site is optimized for your mobile phone or tablet and will bring you the latest scores, stats, photos, and videos. And everything can be shared with your friends from your mobile device to Facebook and Twitter. World Cup nonstop at voafootball.com.
Authorities in Brazil say they have beefed up security around stadiums where World Cup football matches are being played following incidents in several Brazilian cities in recent days. VOA's Scott Bob reports from Rio de Janeiro.
The new security measures were announced after some participants in an otherwise peaceful group of 1,300 demonstrators vandalized banks and cars in Sao Paulo. It was the latest of almost daily protests in various Brazilian cities since the World Cup began last week. The demonstrations had drawn a few dozen to a few hundred protesters, far less than in the months before the tournament began. Security at Rio de Janeiro's Maracanã Stadium was also tightened after 90 ticketless fans broke through barriers during the match between Chile and Spain. The fans ran through the International Media Center, causing considerable damage. More than 80 were detained and ordered to leave Brazil within 72 hours. Security was being heightened around all stadiums, said FIFA Security Director Ralph Mutschke, following meetings with Brazilian authorities.
FIFA is trying to do with LOC and with the Brazilian authorities, security authorities, in order to improve the standards and in order to improve that this will not happen again.
Security officials are particularly worried about stadiums where teams from neighboring countries are playing in upcoming matches. These games have attracted tens of thousands of supporters, many of whom were not able to buy tickets. Scott Bob, VOA News, Rio de Janeiro.
Meanwhile, the world record holder for the marathon, Wilson Kipsang, and the women's world champion, Edna Kiplagat, made their racing debut in the Czech Republic on Saturday. Both were running the half marathon in Olomouc, from where Andy Edwards reports on the outcome.
It just goes to show that athletics can still spring surprises. What was billed as a duel in the men's race between Wilson Kipsang and the man who ranks number 3 in the world all-time list for the marathon, his training partner and fellow Kenyan Dennis Kimeto, failed to materialise. Instead, the pacemaker, Jeffrey Rono, also a member of Kipsang's training group, stayed alongside Kipsang from the start and went clear with a little over 2 kilometres to go and won in 1 hour 17 seconds. Kipsang finished 8 seconds behind. Dennis Kimeto, never in the hunt, was always in the trailing group and finished third, more than a minute adrift. The women's favourite, Edna Kiplagat, did live up to expectations. The world marathon champion broke the event record with 68 minutes 53, almost half a minute clear of last year's winner, the Ethiopian Betlehem Moges. Wilson Kipsang didn't seem too upset at the defeat and credited Jeffrey Rono with a fine performance. Kipsang had chosen him for his main pacemaker for the half marathon, a key point in his build-up for an autumn marathon. Now, Jeffrey Rono is certainly not one of the big Kenyan names, but he looks to have all the credentials to become one. His career record shows just one marathon, 2 hours 15 to his credit, run in India early last year. He now says he believes he can run under 2 hours 8 minutes for the marathon and felt no fear when racing against Wilson Kipsang. This race may well have marked the rise of yet another Kenyan star. This is Andy Edwards for VOA News in Olomouc in the Czech Republic.
Hello, I'm Kim Lewis.
And I'm Yehias Wuhib.
Together we host the Voice of America's informative program, Africa News Tonight.
We present a thorough summary of the day's events, featuring interviews with newsmakers in Africa and the world.
Also, Sunny Young drops in live with sports, and we have features on science, health, and business.
Tune in Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC, right here on the Voice of America.
This is the Voice of America, and you're listening to Nightline Africa.
And still ahead in the program, sports with Segun Adeyemi from the Nigerian commercial capital Lagos, and music from African Collection for your listening pleasure and relaxation.
And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Joner, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs.
It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's go straight to Lagos and join Segun on the dot at DMA. Good evening.
Good evening, Douglas, and good evening, Africa. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports for Sunday, June 22nd.
Put your flags up in the sky, in the sky.
Day 11 at the 2014 FIFA World Cup in Brazil. Three matches are slated for today's Sunday. They are in the order in which they will be played: Belgium versus Russia in Group H, Korea Republic against Algeria, also in Group H, and the United States of America versus Portugal in Group G. On Saturday, three matches will also play. They are Argentina versus Iran, which ended 1-0 against Iran in Group F, Germany versus Ghana, which was drawn 2-2 in Group G, and Nigeria against Bosnia and Herzegovina, which Nigeria won by long goal, also in Group F. Nigeria's victory triggered a massive celebration here in Lagos and across the country. This is because the victory has been long in coming. Nigeria's Super Eagles have waited for all of 16 years for a victory at the four-yearly FIFA World Cup. That wait is now over, thanks to Ozazio Denwige's goal in the 29th minute. That goal, a finish from close range, followed one of many powerful runs by strong striker Emmanuel Emenike after Nigeria fumbled in its opening group match against Iran. The result has raised hopes of the country reaching the round of 16. Only a point is needed by Nigeria from its last Group F game against already qualified Argentina to reach the knockout stage. In other words, Nigeria can advance with a result against Argentina, while Iran needs a win over Bosnia, a Nigeria loss, and a better goal differential than Nigeria before it can advance. Bosnia is already out of the World Cup, irrespective of the outcome of its final match against Iran on Wednesday, the same day that Nigeria will take on Argentina. As I reported earlier, Nigeria's victory on Saturday was celebrated by many soccer fans here. The match, which started at 11 p.m. local time, was played into the early hours of Sunday. But that did not prevent many fans from watching either from the comfort of their homes or at drinking joints and viewing centers. Jubilant fans later celebrated as if Nigeria had already qualified for the second round. The celebrations were reflected by local newspapers on Sunday. 16 years after, Nigeria get World Cup win was how the leadership newspaper reported the victory. Nigeria inches nearer round of 16 as Bosnia bows out of Brazil was the headline in this day newspaper. Other newspaper headlines include Bosnia-Herzegovina out of 2014 World Cup as Nigeria score first goal in the Vanguard, Super Eagles storm Bosnia 1-0 in the Nation, and Eagles overcome Bosnia in World Cup tie in the Punch. Congratulations to the Super Eagles of Nigeria. Congratulations are also in order to the Black Stars of Ghana, which on Saturday played themselves back into reckoning at the World Cup. After losing their opening group match to the United States, all hopes seemed lost for Ghana. But the highly determined Black Stars showed why it's not smart for anyone to write them off yet. They played 2-2 with powerful Germany in their second group game. In the entertaining match, closest second half equalizer saved Germany from defeat in the hands of the red-hot Black Stars. Mario Götze had put Germany ahead in the 51st minute, but Ghana equalized 3 minutes later through Andre Ayew. Ghana captain Asamoah Gyan then put Ghana ahead in the 63rd, only to see Klose cancel out his goal. Even German coach Joachim Löw acknowledged Ghana's impressive outing. Ghana really threw everything they had at us. It was a very animated match. Both teams had many chances and many counter-attacks. That's not how the match was planned, but that's how it turned out, the coach said. For his part, Ghana coach James Appiah described the match as a good competitive game. We did our best and we had many other chances that could have produced goals. Ghanaians have a strong mentality when it comes to football, to fight to the end, no matter what is happening. Appiah said. Now, what does this result portend for Ghana, Germany, and the other teams in the group, Portugal and the United States? The draw kept Germany from qualifying for the knockout stage after two matches. It brought Ghana back into contention for a second round ticket. The US can advance to the round of 16 with a win over Portugal today, Sunday, and that result will also eliminate Portugal. With two African teams, that is Ghana and Nigeria, back to reckoning at the World Cup, what is the fate of Africa's three other teams in Brazil? Cameroon has been eliminated after two successive defeats, as it is now sitting pointless at the bottom of Group A. Ivory Coast has a good chance to advance to the next round after winning one match and losing one. The team is second in Group C with 3 points and looks good to beat Greece on Tuesday in their final group match. And Algeria will need an outright victory against Russia on Thursday in their last group match to take advantage of its mathematical chance of advancing. Back to Saturday's fixtures. Another interesting match was that between Argentina and Iran. The match was closely watched here because both teams are in the same group with Nigeria. The way Iran was defending, it was always going to take a little magic from Lionel Messi to send Argentina into the second round of the World Cup. Until stoppage time on Saturday, Messi had been stifled by Iran's solid backline. Then, out of nowhere, the Argentina captain produced something very special, as he has done so many times for Barcelona, by scoring a stunning goal for a 1-0 victory. Goalkeeper Sergio Romero, who watched the match from the other end of the pitch, said Messi, quote, "rubbed his magic lamp and we won," end of quote. It was Messi's third World Cup goal since 2006. The fixture was also significant for him because it was his 80th appearance for Argentina, surpassing Diego Maradona's 87. Staying in Brazil, Ivory Coast players Yaya and Kolo Touré will stay at the World Cup despite the death of their younger brother. Team spokesman Eric Kaku said they were given the option of leaving the tournament after Ibrahim Touré died on Thursday in England at the age of 28. Kaku said on Saturday that Yaya and Kolo chose to stay with the team for its entire World Cup campaign. The Ivorians played Greece in their final Group C game on Tuesday and will qualify for the next round for the first time with a victory. The Ivory Coast Football Federation said Ibrahim Touré died on the same day his older brothers were involved in the 2-1 loss to Colombia. The federation didn't give a cause of death, but the British media reported that he had been receiving treatment for cancer. And on that note, we end this weekend's edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Thanks a lot for listening. This is Segun Adeyemi in Lagos. Now back to Douglas, the mighty Umpuga, in Washington.
Thank you, Segun. Segun on the dot, Adeyemi will be back again next Sunday for another look at African sports right here on Nightline Africa.
It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time for music from the continent. So sit back, relax, and enjoy.
Sagala nyombo, kubange no sawa ya nungo. Bagande sagala nyombo, eno sawa ya chikire. Mwama sembera, mulamu wasoba. Jangu fetale,
bien se bien koleka
Nekazine Nenzina mu mama Ula mu wajisera Ato muziki zuri sana Nekazine Nenzina mu Ula mu wajisera Ato muziki jamu sana Nse sichalosi Sichalosi Nse sichalosi ndi boss Sichalosi Dance, dance Singubami, kalimunde kenangi Kwenzi jukira muche mfuti Endo osa tukubana Acholeka otada Nebakeni kakanga Itali musana Oh mama ulalaye Oh agariba
Enjole
Oh agariba
Enjole
Katitoba kona chungamba Jango mziki tukusambi Kambe toba kona chungamba Jango enu tuichangi
Non, lui!
Je m'appelle Coupé, Coupé, Bibamba.
Non, l'autre!
Préparez-vous, car les bonnes choses ne durent jamais. Attention, le temps des hommes revient en colère.
That was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America.
Now let's take a closer look at Africa. One man's point of view, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Here is Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. There have been rumblings in the West African landlocked country, Burkina Faso, recently, about the possibility that President Blaise Compaoré might seek to change the country's constitution to allow himself to continue in office. The president himself has not said anything about the prospects, but observers in Ouagadougou, the nation's capital, are certain that plans are being laid for this purpose. It would be regrettable if indeed President Compaoré seeks to continue in office at the end of his current term. Except for a few countries in the continent, such as Cameroon, Zimbabwe, Uganda, and Rwanda, the two-term limit is respected. It is necessary to note that President Compaoré has been in office since 1987, when his close colleague, Captain Thomas Sankara, a darling of many African youth, was overthrown and killed in a coup led by Blaise Compaoré. It was President Compaoré that introduced multi-party system in Burkina Faso, renamed from Upper Volta and meaning the country of honest men. It is amazing how President Compaoré has been able to overcome many difficulties. He was accused of being involved in the destabilization process in the West African sub-region in the 1990s. Initially, it was alleged that he was in alliance with Mr. Charles Taylor of Liberia in promoting in civil conflicts in Liberia and Sierra Leone. In exchange for diamonds, it was alleged that he facilitated the transfer of arms and weapons from Libya under Colonel Gaddafi to Sierra Leone. Yet, the International Criminal Court, ICC, has not been able to collect enough evidence to indict him. President Compaoré has also been involved in a serious dispute with former President Laurent Gbagbo of La Côte d'Ivoire at the time of a civil conflict in the country. President Compaoré was defending Burkinabés who were then living in La Côte d'Ivoire. In recent years, President Compaoré has become a statesman of sorts in the continent. He is participating in many efforts to resolve conflict, and he has been a host to numerous international conferences and meetings. Now, if President Compaoré has been so successful in burnishing his image, one wonders why he wants to change the country's constitution and thereby tarnish his image. Commentators have often failed to probe deeply as to why presidents want to stay long in office. The real problem is many hangers-on of presidents in the continent, in an attempt to protect their own jobs, have often convinced presidents that they are indispensable and should stay in office to protect the nation. Now, the task is that these hangers-on who are unelected should be exposed and made clear that they could not continue this kind of game. This is why it is important that appeals be made to President Blaise Compaoré not to consider changing the constitution. I thank you.
That commentary by Dr. James Joyner, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs.
Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America.
Thanks for joining us tonight. I hope you enjoyed the program. And as you know by now, we're on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. I'm Douglas Impoga.
Join us again on Saturday. I'm Odette Fraser. Have a good evening.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The key suspect in the deadly 2012 attack on the U.S. diplomatic compound in Benghazi, Libya, has been captured by U.S. special forces. Ahmed Abu Qatala will now face the full weight of the U.S. justice system. The arrest of Ahmed Abu Qatala, said U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry, is a clear reminder to anyone who seeks to harm the United States that they will be brought to justice. Four Americans were killed on the night of September 11, 2012, when armed assailants attacked the U.S. special mission in Benghazi, Libya. Four American personnel, including Ambassador Christopher Stevens, were killed in the violence. It was the first time since 1979 that a U.S. ambassador was killed in the line of duty. The United States, which captured Qatala unilaterally, continues to work through its embassy in Tripoli with Libya's democratically elected institutions to advance shared interests, including establishing rule of law and stability throughout the country. The United States stood by the Libyan people 3 years ago as they rose up against the tyrant Muammar Gaddafi. The United States continues to support them in their desire to build democratic institutions that will provide them with security, protect their universal rights, and help rebuild their economy. In an official statement, U.S. Secretary of State Kerry said the vision of a peaceful and productive new nation will guide Libya's future, and they have a friend in the United States as they pursue that vision. We will remain vigilant against all acts of terrorism, said President Barack Obama in an official statement. We will also sustain our support for the Libyan people as they work to overcome years of tyranny and do the difficult work of building a democracy.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.